Hey, it's Trey here from the Modern Romantic Podcast. David's interview here truly spoke to me as a musician, so I wanted to personally promote David's work as a composer. If you are a solo musician or a band director looking for chamber works to perform, David has digital downloads of sheet music available for purchase on his website right now. His works include various styles, instrumentation, and level of difficulty. I'm personally in love with Edge of the Window, which you'll hear us discuss in the episode, but there are so many other great works to see. There's really something there for everybody, so check it out today by visiting davidschumacher.com. And last thing, when you purchase from David's website, please record, upload, and tag David and the Modern Romantic Podcast in your video. We really would love to watch it and hear about it. Thank you so much. Now, back to the interview. Hello and welcome to the Modern Romantic Podcast, where we celebrate romanticism through passionate people doing incredible things. Hi, I'm incredibly jazzed to be here. My name's Trey. You can find me at OrphyTunes on Instagram and YouTube. And I'm joined by my incredible co-host, Emily, who's shaking her head right now.
I'm doing what?
You're shaking your head at me.
Yeah, because the only thing I could think of was jazz hands. And then I couldn't think of a good joke or anything to go with that. So I was like, as per usual, I'm stuck. And that's okay. That's okay. Yay, jazz hands.
Jazz hands.
I feel like if you say that, you have to say it with that same enthusiasm.
We say that at work quite a bit when we're like really not feeling our greatest, and then it's like, how are you feeling today? I'm like, jazz hands. And they're like, oh, you're feeling that level peppy. Got it.
Yeah, you can't really say it. Oh, jazz hands. You can't say it like that. It doesn't work the same.
Just like
No.
you can't say bubbles angry.
I've heard that. I'm not gonna try. Don't trick
Well,
me into trying that.
dang it. All right. Well, puns about jazz. I'm sure that you can guess who our incredible guest is tonight. But Emily, would you do our guest of honor the pleasure of introducing him?
Yes, I would like to welcome the remarkable David Schumacher, a prolific jazz composer, musician, and dedicated educator. His acclaimed jazz album, Edge of the Mind, is a testament to his musical prowess. Welcome to the podcast, David Schumacher. Yay!
Thank you, Emily. Thank you, Trey.
Yeah, that's right. Jazz hands. If
That
you're
is
driving
awesome.
right now, don't do jazz hands.
No jazz hands.
No jazz hands. Which, funny enough, just like random tidbit, not jazz hands, but like if you shake your hands back and forth, to my understanding, that is supposed to be the way of signing applause
Oh, yeah.
in ASL. Well, David, to kind of kick us off, one, I have to tell you, our listening audience probably knows by now that I might like music or something. I don't know. But more specifically, how much I enjoyed jazz theory, listening to jazz, growing up with not a lot of jazz background, but becoming more immersed in it as I go along in my music career. But I am really curious, how did you get started in jazz? And how did you get into being a composer, an educator? Just how did David Schumacher come to be?
You want the whole story?
I want the whole story.
All right. I started early with music, about four. I started piano lessons. And when I got to fifth grade and they introduced the band instruments, I chose saxophone, not because I had any desire to play saxophone. A friend sitting next to me chose saxophone. So I was locked in at that point. And my middle school band director, Dick Rabidoux, who I'm still in touch with, got me into his jazz band in middle school, and he is the one responsible for introducing me to that music and the art of improvisation. And I was hooked very soon in the process and never really looked back as far as jazz goes. And then as far as composition, I've always dabbled in creating my own music, whether it was as a young middle schooler with a sequencer and a synthesizer and doing all of that kind of stuff, writing little tunes in those ways and improvising over them. And then that gradually evolved through a confluence of events, really, to become my focus eventually by the time I got to late undergrad, grad school.
See, with me, it was always about getting people to actually stay on the same pitch so we didn't like broaden our horizons to things.
We purposely avoid staying on any pitch for too long.
I wonder what that could be. My jazz theory teacher in college always said the most interesting melodies are written everything above the fifth. If you can write with seventh and above, you're golden.
Mm.
For those of us who may not know exactly what that means, do you think you could explain it to a common layperson?
Why don't I let the resident educator?
Well, what exactly do you mean? And then we can expound on it.
Yeah, what's fifth and seventh and...
Sure. So like over a chord structure. So you've got typically a three chord structure that can expound with additions on top of it. So say you have a chord structure of the one, a four, a five, a one, which is your typical cadence structure that you can find in most music. Okay. Over top of that, a lot of melodies are written with the same notes that appear in a chord. So like a chord could be notes on a piano, C, E, G, and your melody could be a note that it falls in that chord. So C, E, or G. My jazz theory teacher said that the most interesting melodies are written with notes above that. So you're essentially writing with something that doesn't always appear in the chord itself. So it kind of dances over the top of the chord. And really the chord is just kind of there as supporting while you let the melody just kind of soar above that, but it's make it still sound like it's part of the chord structure itself.
Now I see where you're going with that, Trey, right? So we would refer to those notes as extensions to the chord. Mm-hmm. So if we think of the notes in the scale 1 through 8, and then we continue on, you get 9, 10, 11, 12, and so on. So the 9, 11, and 13 are the upper structures to those chords, or the extensions to those chords. And that's where all the color is. That's where all the spice is. That's where all the flavor is, if we're talking about harmony and melody.
Thank you for explaining that. I think okay. I understand flavor and color. So no, I followed it. I followed it. And that was very helpful. Thank you.
You'd be surprised how much I talk about food and cooking when I'm teaching jazz, talking about flavors and spice and getting into ice cream flavors and all sorts of stuff to help the students understand the concept of harmonic color through a vehicle that they're more familiar with.
That's wonderful. And how much more memorable, I think.
I think it helps, sure. And we talk about guacamole more than just about anything you could possibly think of on the menu.
Are you serious?
Oh, very serious. Okay. Guacamole is among the most important food groups.
I agree wholeheartedly. Oh,
please tell me that you let people audit your courses remotely.
Just want to hear about guacamole. One year, my students often give me a small gift at the end of the year. And we had talked about guacamole so much that year that they gave me a basket full of avocados and cilantro and all the ingredients I needed to make guacamole.
What a wonderful gift.
Yeah.
Oh. So within that, I do have to ask, what has been the most surprising analogy that you've used food-wise besides guacamole to talk about color and texture within music?
Well, ice cream flavors come up all the time when we're talking about improvisation, kind of piggybacking on what you were talking about earlier, Trey, when we talk about the basic 1-3-5-7 chord and the extensions up above. When we're talking about improvisation and looking at specific notes and how they sound against the chord, I might give an example of a C played over a C dominant seventh chord. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, you know, what does that sound like to you? Does it sound kind of vanilla? Does it sound mint chocolate chip? Is it exciting or is it kind of plain? And then we might play a sharp 11 over that chord. Okay, now can you hear that that's a lot more colorful? It's got a lot more edge to it. That's more like a Rocky Road kind of a flavor. And so they start to, you know, understand that concept at a young age through ice cream.
Again, would happily audit this course.
Do your students get on board and come up with their own food-related analogies then too?
We can get into some heated debates over ice cream choices when we're comparing to notes. Absolutely. They do not let me get away with anything.
I bet not. How wonderful, though. I mean, it sounds constructive for the most part anyway.
For the most part. We do go on some tangents that maybe go on a little too long, but that's okay.
It's part of the fun of it. They must love you. We've as talked a teacher. To... I'm sorry.
Well, we have some fun. A lot of what I do in the jazz program is after school, so things are always a little more relaxed, and we can let loose a little bit and go on those tangents, and you know, we start talking about recipes, and we start talking about other food-related things, and we bring it back eventually.
That's really great, though.
Talking a little bit towards your composition history just a little bit, a lot of the pieces that you've been able to put out on your website and also through the CD that Emily had mentioned earlier, I'm sorry, the album that Emily mentioned earlier, I've had a chance to listen to them, and believe it or not, one of my favorite one is... oh, why did I just blank on the name of it? Edge of the Window.
Edge of the Window.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's by far one of my favorites. And what really inspires you when you're composing to write some of your pieces?
It's a wide range of things that might inspire a piece. Nature is a big one for me. But the Edge of the Window specifically, there's what I think is a fun story that goes along with that. For fun, on occasion, I will do sport kiting. So it's, think of, you know, a traditional kite, but mm-hmm. it's on two lines instead of one. And you can actually make the kite do tricks. And so you can make it spin, you can make it dive, you can make it float, you can make it do all sorts, you can make it hover. All sorts of fun things, and that's called sport kiting. And so I was going through a phase where I was doing a lot of this.
Neat.
And when you talk about sport kiting, it's what's called a wind window. And depending on where the kite is in that window, it'll behave differently. If it's way up at the top of the window, it'll be quite violent in a heavy wind. But when it's on the edge of the window, it relaxes and you can make the kite hover at that edge of the window. And so that was the inspiration behind this tune, talking about, you know, that feeling of just sort of hovering at the edge of that wind window. And then there were moments where it goes back towards the top of the window where it's more violent and such. So that was the premise behind that piece.
I like it.
I'm now going to have to go back and listen to that, knowing that story. I've never been wind kiting before, but... I'll get back to you. I'll let you know.
It's quite fun.
Yeah, I've seen it before, but not like up close.
Yeah, I mean, in Newburyport, we're right on the ocean, right on the beach. So I'll go to the beach with my boys, and we have a few of these kites, and we'll fly them together, and it's a lot of fun. And then we recently got into a more advanced level of sport kiting, where it's a huge foil, 6 or 8 feet wide,
cool.
That will literally pull you down the beach in a stiff wind, and you have to put every bit of energy you have into digging into the sand so that you don't get tossed into the ocean.
Sure.
It's quite fun.
Tossed into the ocean. Have you been tossed into the ocean?
No, but we've definitely face planted a number of times.
I'm now half expecting a piece to be called face planting.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
We'll watch for that. That's great. What is something about what you do, or what part of what you do, makes you go, yes, this is why I do what I do?
Well, that depends. As a composer with my composer hat on, it's hearing a new piece for the first time performed. That is a transcendent moment that you just can't replicate anywhere else. It's pure magic, pure magic. So with the composer hat, that's where I land. And as an educator, it's getting the feedback from your students and your parents that you have in some way impacted their lives. And that's a wonderful feeling. One of the things that I love about what I do as an educator, I am throughout the entire district, throughout our entire instrumental music program.
Okay.
So I start students in fourth grade and I work with them continuously in various capacities all the way through graduation from high school. So it's entirely possible that I'll work with a student for 9 years in a row,
Wow.
and you can really develop a great relationship with the students, with their families, and with the community in that kind of a situation. It makes it a little tougher to see them graduate because you've gone that far with them, but it's a wonderful thing to see them grow, to see them mature, to see who they become as human beings, not just as musicians. And that's beyond rewarding.
That's awesome. Yeah, what a reward.
If someone was considering joining your jazz program, what's one thing about the program that you would want them to know prior to diving in headfirst?
We're going to improvise, and there's no way around it. Students can be very hesitant to let go and improvise freely in front of their peers. And so I try to get them warmed up to the concept in elementary school. So we do improvisation exercises as early as fourth grade. And hopefully, by the time they get to middle school and they can be in the jazz band, they've done it enough times that it's not some new scary concept, but something they've been doing since their very first year. That's the concept, anyway.
Awesome.
That was honestly one of the most nerve-wracking things to be asked to do with jazz for me. And so I'm so glad that you do it early.
I think it's really important because otherwise you build that anxiety over something and then it becomes much worse in your mind than it really is in reality. But improvisation is the most beautiful part of jazz, and for me, the most beautiful part of music. And I want students to get to a point where they feel comfortable to do so in front of their peers. I mean, if you think about it, and this is what I tell my students, improvisation is actually, in many ways, easier than sitting and reading the music on a piece of paper in front of you because you can't get anything wrong. You literally can't make a mistake. So I try to empower them with that confidence that there are no wrong notes. You cannot do anything incorrectly. There's no rhythm you can do that's going to be wrong, no note you can choose, and hopefully get them to a point where they're just free to explore. And then obviously over time, we work to refine those skills so that they become an effective, mature improviser.
So I have a question. I have a lot right now because not knowing much about jazz myself, I mean I've listened to it and I do listen to it, but I don't think I realized how much improvisation might go into it. And I bet there are a lot of people, unless I'm alone and everybody else knew but me, I bet a lot of people don't realize how much improvisation actually happens. This is a new concept for me. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, it depends on what you're listening to specifically, but in general, especially if we're talking about traditional jazz, 80 plus percent of what you're hearing is improvised. And that's not just from, let's say, the saxophone player or the trumpet player, but everything the bass player is doing, that bass player is improvising continuously because they're walking bass lines that are not predetermined. So they're continuously improvising as they play. The pianist or the guitarist or a vibraphonist who might be accompanying the soloist or the people playing the melody, they're improvising what they're doing to accompany that person continuously. The drummer, even though they have somewhat of a prescribed expectation of playing, let's say, a swing groove, they're still supplementing and embellishing that groove in a number of different ways that, again, is completely spontaneous based on what that person, that musician is hearing in the moment. And so again, for me, that's the beauty of jazz, is that you never know what's going to happen. And if you are open with your ears and you are in the moment, and we can talk about mindfulness all day long, you will make some music. That's where the magic happens.
That's pretty awesome. I guess I just didn't realize. I guess I'm not exactly, I played piano, but like not jazz. So I didn't, you know, I'm used to piano is reading music unless you can somehow memorize it, or you're one of those lucky people who can play by ear.
Right.
So this is new for me, and I kind of think this is awesome. I really do.
It's really awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would not think of improvisation in music as something that would be embraced by anyone, or especially not a teacher. So this is really cool for me.
And then if you get into more modern jazz, and especially in my world as a composer, we tend to reverse that ratio. There's going to be much more written music than there will be improvised music, but it is still an integral component to that composition. And what I've always tried to do is integrate the improvisation in a way that's seamless to the written material. So I will intentionally weave improvisation into written material so that the listener doesn't necessarily know if what they're hearing is composed or improvised. And then that might quickly evolve into a more, you know, intentional and noticeable improvisation section of a song. Oh, yeah. And so that was something that I really loved doing. And I would even, in some pieces, actually Edge of the Window, Trey, that you were mentioning before, I believe does this, where the soloist actually plays a written line that interacts with the composed lines, and that written line evolves directly into their solo, their improvised solo.
What? Okay. Well, I'm going to make note of that. I'm going to go back to that.
So when you go back to it, the first solo on that song is a trumpet solo. And the first, I don't know what it is offhand, 16 measures, 24 measures or so, sounds improvised, but it's actually something that I composed for the soloist that intentionally interacts with the rest of the band. And then that just naturally evolves into his own freely improvised solo.
You sneaky dog. That's brilliant. I love that so much.
It's fun to, in my opinion, it's fun to confound the listener's expectations. And as a composer, you can have a lot of fun with that. And you can trick the listener, or you can try to bring them on your emotional journey to a greater degree by doing things like that.
We have two things from the chat. One is, Josh said, I had a crutch for improv. If you hit a funny wrong sounding note, just bend it up or down a half step.
Right. So there is an expression in jazz that you're always a half step away from a correct note.
Okay. I get it.
Right. So, and then there is also the expression that there are no wrong notes in jazz. And that is true, so long as you resolve those notes along the way. You can get away with anything that you want.
Oh, okay.
So again, that's the beauty of tension and release in jazz. We talk about these extensions that Trey was talking about earlier, and how they create an energy against the chord. And sometimes that energy can just sit and float. And sometimes that energy needs to resolve, otherwise it becomes abrasive.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we've all, we can relate to that. And that's that's true for a lot of other art areas as well. And then the other one was, Josh also asked, what eras of jazz inspire and speak to you?
Wow. So The most influential would be, you know, my one generation before me in the world of modern jazz composers. So people like Maria Schneider and Bob Brookmeyer and Jim McNeely, their approach to composing jazz was revolutionary on so many levels. And so trying to live in that vein and carry that music forward in some way that reflects my own personal experience rather than their own is, I would say, where I taken my greatest inspiration.
Awesome.
For you as an educator, you've talked about like your love of educating others and watching them go from being in fourth grade all the way through high school, and then watching them just grow and develop along the way. So what is one thing, or why do your students motivate you to continue being an educator?
Seeing that growth and watching those students mature and knowing that you have made a lasting impression on them, you have given them something that they can take on the journey through life is just a magical, magical feeling. So that's what I love to see. I love to see that student turn into who they were meant to turn into, to evolve into their own person, their own human being. And I was able to influence in some small way that journey is wonderful. And one of the things that I've talked about in some of my writing is those students go on and they live their lives, and maybe music is a focal point of their life, or maybe it's a tangential component of their life, but they routinely come back as alumni and they come back to give back to the program. I've had so many graduates come back and sit in on a rehearsal or help out giving feedback to the next generation of players. And it's such a beautiful thing to see that cycle of mentorship where the students go through the program, they graduate, they take their own life experience, and they come back to the program. It's, you know, supplementing what I'm giving those students, and each successive generation gets a better education than the previous generation because they've got all that compounded experience pouring back into the program. And it's just wonderful. And I love staying in touch with those students. And as I mentioned before, you know, I'm still in touch with my middle school band director. It's just great to go back and see how they're doing. I've got students who are doing this for a living that are, you know, making it in New York.
Awesome.
And living the life, living the dream that they wanted to live. And they come back for advice. They come back to show off what they've been doing, you know, all of these things, and they become peers rather than students. And that's a beautiful thing in itself to develop and nurture these relationships, you know, long-term. And that's something that, you know, your average English teacher or math teacher doesn't get to enjoy. No fault of their own, but it's just the nature of seeing those students for 9 years in a row, you develop a different kind of relationship.
Sure. How awesome to be able to see someone grow up. And having taught them so much yourself and go and make a musical life for themselves, and you get to see that happen and go
it's
on
beautiful.
The journey with them.
And there have been several students who have decided not to make music a focal point of their life, mm-hmm. but they still come back, or I bump into them at a function and they'll say, you know, I'm sad that I don't play anymore, but these skills that we learned in the jazz band or in whatever ensemble they were a part of, those skills that we learned, I'm still using in my job as a computer programmer. I'm still using those skills in some other way. And that, you know, what we're teaching in music and the arts in general, these are life skills. These are skills that transcend any specific path. And, you know, again, that's wonderful to see these students embracing what they've learned and applying it in a different direction than maybe was expected at the beginning.
Yeah, that's awesome. And lifelong things they're taking with them. Lessons you taught them, things they learned, music knowledge in general. I mean, right. You can't hear a song on the radio even without taking some knowledge that you gave them or they learned with you, and like, oh yeah, right. I know what that instrument is. Or...
And we're surrounded by music, and we don't realize the degree to which music is a part of our life, because sometimes it's just in the background. We don't really focus on it, but it's such an integral component to how we live our lives that to be, you know, musically ignorant is a challenge for people, because we do need some skill set to be able to navigate that world and allow the music to do its job of, you know, helping influence your personal well-being.
Yeah. Kaz, who's in our chat on Twitch, said, "Music is literally life, and I stand by that."
It is. There's a term in education, lifelong learning, and that is a huge component of what we do in music. You know, unlike, you know, playing soccer, which you can do only to a certain age before things start to get difficult, you can play music your entire life, and to have music in the house is a glorious thing. I mean, my two sons are both musicians, and there is never an afternoon where there is not live music happening in our house. And it's just tremendous to have that energy, be surrounded by that energy. So I'm hoping that all of my students, again, are able to keep music in their life in some way, because it's a wonderful tool to help navigate through any situation.
I think it really speaks to how successful of a program and the spark and the charisma that you bring to such a program. I think back on music educators that I've taken lessons from or that I've joined their music program, and they don't have these stories of people coming back to share the mentorship that you do. So I really think that speaks to the special thing that you bring to not only to your family, but also to them and their journey through music with you.
Well, thank you. I think a lot of that is also just the nature of jazz and improvisation. It is a more intimate art form than sitting in concert band. And so we share more life experiences when we're talking about improvisation, and when we are trying to pull from those life experiences and incorporate them into our improvisation. You develop a deeper connection with the students than you would in some other context. So that definitely helps the situation.
Thinking back to my time in opera, yes. Yes, I can definitely say that, yes.
Yeah, the opera world probably is not as warm and fuzzy as the jazz world in that way.
No, we just want to talk about our feelings, and our feelings are normally loud and very high. The other thing I wanted to ask was, what is one thing about jazz or about being an educator that you wish more people would ask you?
How much guacamole do you want?
Yeah, right. What do I wish they would ask me? Well, I think it's a great conversation for students to have when they start to think about what they're going to do with music for the rest of their lives, so that we don't get into a black and white, am I going to do music or am I not going to do music, but how can I incorporate music? Because a lot of my students are very musical, but they don't want to pursue music. So maybe they have strong math skills or physics skills, and they would be perfect for, you know, a sound recording program, or they would be perfect for acoustic work. They would be perfect for some other field that incorporates music. So not seeing music as this or that, but seeing music as more prolific and the opportunities to incorporate music into their life, into their work life, would be a great place to start.
I agree. There, even in my undergrad, there was this small recording. Someone was trying to start a recording program, bought all the technology for it, bought everything for it. But the school itself didn't really seem to embrace it at the time. Mm-hmm. And this was 2007, 2010-ish. But I recently went back on their website just to see where the program has grown into. And they now have not only a degree in audio technology, they now have a master's in it. They now have all of these other things that are being supported by the arts, whereas before it was either you are a performance or you're an educator. There was no tangential program to explore.
Right. And usually, as you phrased it, performer or an educator, never both. And that's a huge problem in our higher education. I think we separate those two things. And in order to be a good educator, you need to be a good musician. And in order to be a good performer, it's helpful to have those skills on the other side. So I'd like to see some more blending of those two worlds. Mm-hmm. But you're right. The engineering side of things is a new phenomenon, and it's growing considerably. And I have several students who are working as sound engineers in some capacity, either in studio, doing studio work or doing live sound. I have a student right now who's on tour with the Red Hot Chili Peppers, touring the world. And it's been doing so for a couple of years. He's an audio tech for that tour. And it's a wonderful opportunity for these students to make use of that music that they learned, but perhaps not performing on an instrument or teaching in a classroom, but they're still making use of those skills and in enjoying and immersing themselves in music in some way.
I really want one of them at some point just to walk up to one of the instrumentalists and just go, yeah, you were flat there, and just walk away.
Yeah, that would be a fun reaction to see.
From our chat, we have a few comments I want to make sure we get read. One of them is, my kid is autistic and my only way to communicate with them is music. Music is so beautiful and so amazing. A good music teacher can change the mind and hearts of their students.
I did see that comment, and I did mean to come back to it. Absolutely on point. We've had so many students on the spectrum who thrive in the music program, and they are able to make those connections with music or through music that they struggle to make in other contexts. And so, you know, a student who might be struggling in their classes, they come to the music program or the ensemble, and they're beaming ear to ear with a smile, and you can see a true, heartfelt, authentic love and reaction to what they're doing in that ensemble. And even if they're not capable of performing at the highest level, they're still getting just as much out of that experience as those students who do perform at a high level. And further, I've had other students on the spectrum who have been phenomenal musicians. They tend to have excellent ears, and they can do all sorts of remarkable things. Maybe not in the traditional sense of reading music on the page, but using those skills with their ears to create music, to improvise, and come at it in that way. And so it is absolutely a wonderful outlet for those students.
The other comment was, I really want to know if David has seen the video clips that have been zooming around the TikTok app of a trumpet player playing, and the way he plays his trumpet will give you the goosebumps.
I have not. I will admit freely that I do not have TikTok or see TikTok ever.
You know what, Kaz? Send that to me, and I want to see it. And David, I'll be happy to forward you the link.
Okay.
So if let's pretend for a second I'm not much into jazz. Like, I've heard some of the names. I've heard Coltrane. I've heard of Charlie Parker. I might not be able to pick out which one those are if I hear music. So let's pretend I want to, I'm interested in learning more. I want to hear more that maybe is, how do I put this? I want to hear some of the best jazz out there. Who are you going to recommend that I listen to?
Well, that is a really tough question because there is a short list of people that you absolutely need to listen to at some point. But I am very careful to suggest people follow their own thread. So everyone gets into this music from a different place.
Yeah.
I came into traditional jazz from listening to Spyro Gyra and Weather Report and like Brecker Brothers and, you know, electronic wind instruments and all of this crazy technology of the early and mid 80s. I had never listened to Charlie Parker or Miles Davis or any of those people until I went to music camp one summer. And everybody looked at me like I was crazy. Why are you listening to that stuff? You need to listen to Charlie Parker. You need to listen to these other people. And I started to do so, but it was very foreign to me and it took a while to get into it. So eventually I got there, but it was important for me to do it through my own thread, my own journey. So when you listen to something, it pulls you to something else and it pulls you to something else. It's like real life Pandora. So whatever music somebody is listening to now, if you just take something else in that direction towards jazz, you'll eventually find your way towards that short list of traditional jazz masters that you should get to at some point.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, obviously music affects everybody differently. And like you said, everybody should go at it through their own thread. They should. And so I definitely, I just wondered who's your go-to? Who's your top?
Who's my go-to?
Yeah.
It really depends on my mood.
Yeah.
You know, listening to mid to late 1950s Miles Davis or Cannonball Adderley is a really nice sweet spot for me. But I will spend just as much, if not more, time listening to, again, my contemporaries in my generation or the generation before in that modern jazz composition world, because I feel like that's what I connect to more. And that's what I'm connected to when I'm writing my own music. And so that's where I tend to live. But honestly, I listen to as much non-jazz as I do jazz these days, especially again, with my boys being musicians. They're introducing me to new music that I wouldn't necessarily listen to. And oddly enough, I think some of the stuff that I listen to is making a, you know, resurgence in some way in my boys' generation. So I'm getting to relive some of my glory days from the 90s through the music that they're listening to. And that's a ton of fun as well, because we can sit down and we can do a late night jam and play along to some of that and have a lot of fun.
That's awesome.
What do you think our listening audience would be most surprised to know that you listen to that's not jazz related?
I don't know if this would be a surprise to them, but I'll throw out my current favorite group. It's a group from Australia, Hiatus Coyote. And they do this wonderful mix of soul, R&B, some jazz influence. And I think it's remarkable. What they're doing rhythmically and sonically, I can listen to it all day long. It's fantastic. The Dirty Projectors is another group that I like quite a bit. I don't know if you're familiar with them. They do some really fascinating rhythmic and metric modulations and superimpositions and all sorts of crazy rhythmic things that you really need to sit down and listen to for quite a long time before you can figure it out. Radiohead is one of my favorite groups of all time. I love Jose Gonzalez. I love Emiliana Torini. These are more sort of leaning towards the singer-songwriter end of things, but remarkable music and lyrics that they compose.
I think you just made Cause in our chat like very happy by knowing Hyatt is Coyote.
Oh, is that right? Yeah, it's if you haven't checked them out, it's definitely worth the effort.
That's so interesting. I was not personally expecting Radiohead to be in that list of things.
No.
I will admit that my breadth of knowledge when it comes to music outside of like the top 40 is not that great. But if you talk to me about like opera, a little bit of jazz, and and like top 40, I'm your guy.
Nice.
So I'm always happy to add new things.
Josh also asked, Spyro Gyra, how about Bella Fleck and the Flecktones?
Love Bella Fleck and the Flecktones. I started listening to them when I was in middle school. One of the other students in the jazz band heard about them and introduced us to them. And I've definitely checked them out over the years. And it's funny, like we're talking about all these different kinds of music. And one of the things in the education world that I've been really focused on in the last few years is social emotional learning. And the conversation we had earlier about the autistic child having sort of that safe place and that authentic connection with music, that's what social emotional learning is all about, and that mindfulness element. And so these different kinds of musics that we're listening to, they all serve a different purpose for each individual. And so getting into a conversation, and I've had teachers and I've had peers in the past, so you can't listen to that. That's not jazz, or that's not traditional jazz, or, you know, whatever the comment might be. And, you know, I've evolved to a place where all music is good. All music is healthy. Whatever connects with you is what you should be listening to, because we can't make that decision for someone else. We can't say this music is better than this music. We can't say that this music is somehow more important than this other music. Whatever connects with you, it's an emotional experience. And in a lot of ways, it's a nostalgic experience. You know, if we think back to music we listened to as a child, it's usually connected to some other memory. It's not just the music itself. And so what might be meaningful to me is meaningful because of some life experience that's connected to when I learned that music or listened to that music for the first time. And if Trey doesn't have that same life experience, he's not going to connect to that music in the same way. And that's just how this goes. And so I think it's really important that we are healthy about those different musical persuasions and allowing everyone to, again, follow their own thread and connect with music that connects, that they connect to naturally.
Yeah.
I think what helps me, especially when we're talking about music, is to know, like, if it may not be my cup of tea, but to hear someone talk about why they love the music, watching that like sparkle in their eye when they're talking about it and sharing that story of like, I was five sitting in the kitchen while my mother was baking cookies and she had, Santana playing in the background. Like it's really, I get so invested in listening to someone's love and how much joy that a song brings to them that I'm mm-hmm. more willing to go and listen to something to say, okay, well, they had such an incredible experience with this. What possibilities does this have for me? And then I start to kind of evolve that way with listening to a recommendation.
Absolutely. It's so powerful. Music itself, and also those connections to those memories and to those feelings that you've developed in connection with that music. It's absolutely so. And again, that gets back into this well-being concept. You know, music being in a program like I have, you know, we focus so much on our performances. We're in an ensemble. We have a concert coming up. Let's prepare for that concert. Let's perform that concert. But music is so much more than that. It has so much power to impact your own personal well-being and that of the people around you, the community around you. And that's one thing that I've really tried to focus on with my students is understanding and recognizing that power for themselves and for others. So you can play your instrument and you can do so well, but you can also use that music as an instrument for good, for change, for impact in other ways for other people. And we can think of music as sort of being not something that we do for ourselves, but a gift that we give to others. And that becomes so much more powerful than just sitting in a seat playing your saxophone trying to get the right notes for the concert coming up. And that's where we make that connection to those life skills that we were talking about earlier, and that lifelong learning and keeping the music and what you learn through that art form present as you go through your journey, and being able to apply it in other ways and other places in your life.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear that.
And a lot of that, if I'm just continuing on that thread, so much of that for me comes out of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. That experience really changed how I looked at education, music education specifically.
Yeah.
Because we were forced to go different directions than we were used to going. Mm-hmm. And looking at music in different ways, and through that new lens, you know, for myself, I really dug deep and asked some heady questions of, you know, what do I want music education to look like? What do I want my students to walk away with? What skills, what understandings? And it was different than what I thought it was. And so, again, learning about music and the power it has for well-being, learning about empathy. You know, we do all of these community events. We do Veterans Day, we do Memorial Day, we do all of this kind of stuff. And, you know, if we're honest, the students of this generation don't usually have a strong connection to the traditional music that you'd perform in a ceremony like that. Mm-hmm. And we learn that it doesn't matter if you have a connection as the performer. The whole purpose of our performance is to give to those people in attendance for whom that music is tremendously meaningful. And so bridging that connection to your audience is so important as a performer of any art form. And it really started to make a noticeable difference for my students when they started thinking about it in those ways, rather than just, oh, I'm playing this music that I really don't like for these people I don't really know. And so that has become a very important thread.
I'm kind of taken back to learning a piece when I was in undergrad from Kurt Vile's Street Scene. And it's a scene in which this father is just kind of coming to grips with being a very staunch conservative that he is. And really at the time I was so incredibly liberal that I had a really hard time connecting with this piece itself. And I remember just being so frustrated. Vocally, it wasn't coming out. Musically, it wasn't coming out. It was just, I'm singing notes on a page. I'm just performing it. And I remember some conversations that I had to have with my voice instructor, where we spent probably half of my lessons just talking through the piece. And he just was talking to me about my thoughts. What is this person angry about? What are you currently angry about? And trying to help connect those things together of, you know, you might be at odds with this particular piece, but if you dig and you really think about it, where I was at the beginning of the semester with the piece and where I ended up by the time of my recital were two incredibly different things. And for me, it's still one of my favorite performed pieces. To any pianist who has ever played that piece for me, I'm sorry, but it is such a wonderfully cathartic piece because of what I found through that journey.
Absolutely. Those connections are vital to an authentic performance. And I would imagine that in your performance of that piece, you were so connected to it you know, that you were completely immersed, you know, we'll use the slang, you were in the zone, mm-hmm. right, with that piece, and you become completely in the moment. I mean, that's what mindfulness is all about. You're not thinking about anything else. You're not even aware that you're performing that piece. You're so immersed in it. You are one with that performance, with that character. That is just, it's an elusive experience, but it's a magical experience. And if you can find that even a couple of times, you know, in your career, then you've done a wonderful thing.
Hey guys, it's Josh. I got to jump in here for just a second because this is really getting to me in a really great way. I just want to share a quick experience that I had. Ninth grade concert band. And I was playing with the high school band, everything else. And we were tapped to play for a ceremony down in the harbor. I grew up in Duluth, right on Lake Superior. So there's big maritime area there. But we were playing a couple of pieces for Pearl Harbor Day. And there was a presentation going on and all of this for veterans from World War II that day specifically, so on. And we'd been practicing Battle Hymn of the Republic for months. And, you know, we played it and it was good and it felt right and everything else. But then the day of, we're sitting there, you know, in off to the side of this, you know, stage and everything else, this assembled group of probably 150 or so World War II veterans. And we start playing that song. And within, I don't know, a handful of bars, you could start seeing the emotional impact ripple through that crowd. Mm-hmm. And by the time we got done, and the version that we played had a bit of echo taps. So you have our lead trumpet playing taps in front of our group. And then our second lead trumpet had gone out to the entryway of the building and was playing it from outside. So you get this call and response. And I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it now, even. There wasn't a single dry eye in the place, band included. You know, we're 9th, 10th, 11th grade. You know, we're not, that's not who we are as teenagers. But every last one of us, every person in the place was absolutely moved in that moment. And it's still to this day, probably one of the most powerful musical memories that I have.
Yeah, that's a beautiful story. I'm glad that you had that experience, and I'm glad that your band was able to give that experience to the veterans that were there, because that's exactly what music is all about. Like, that is right. The power, that is why we do it. And if, you know, again, if we can inspire this generation of students coming through to see music as that gift that they're giving to others in moments like that, then we've done our job.
Yeah. That was really a turning point for me in my musical career. You know, up to that point, it'd been fun to play, mm-hmm. but I hadn't had that emotional gut punch, right, where you're seeing, like you said, David, we're giving them this wonderful moment. And yeah, it's phenomenal.
Absolutely. Again, but unfortunately, not everybody has the privilege of experiencing what you just described, and that's unfortunate. So as educators, our job is to try to get as many students into a place where they are open to an experience like that, and they can bring that connection to their audience.
To anyone who's out there listening and thinking, should I take music lessons? Should I go take voice lessons? Should I? Yes. The answer is yes.
Yeah. It is.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Kaz in the chat said that music had life and it gave life to every person. Every single person, everyone felt it. The music moved hearts. Commenting on Josh's story, I believe.
Right. Because like we were saying before, it's not just hearing that music. That music brings memories and experiences and emotions with it. And that's where that power is held for those listeners.
I think if you can walk away with it, with those stories, that's what you're going to remember the most about it and inspire others. So for me, I'm going to echo what Kaz said in our chat, and that this podcast is going to inspire people. This is one of those episodes I think that is going to be really touching to those, the more that they listen to it and they hear all the testimonies. And I even think Emily has a story about like the impact is immediately after the episode with Jen Beaupre. You were talking to me about like what you wanted to do with music. Yes, was she forced to sing a little bit on our podcast? Yes. But she was talking about like the joy that came from doing that and what she kind of wanted to do. And like, yeah, it was terrifying, but how much like fun that was. And I got you out of your comfort zone.
Yeah, it was definitely out of my comfort zone. Yeah. I went into that episode going, I'm not going to sing. I'm not singing. She better not make us sing. In fact, even before the show, like, you know, like that behind the scenes, you know, a few minutes we have where we chat till we go live. I was like, we're not singing today, Jen. And she was like, ha ha. Yeah, you put me on the spot on live, on a live show. I will sing. And so I did. But yeah, you know, like, I think there's something in a lot of us where we see great singers, great musicians, people who have touched us somehow with music, and we want to be part of that somehow, whether it's we want to sing too, or we want to play too. We want to, you know, it's, we go to concerts to feel that. We go experience music again and again and again to feel that and be part of it somehow. And that was one thing that I always thought I struggled with was, and we won't go there, but I always thought I, you know, one day it'd be cool to learn how to sing. One day it'd be cool to be able to really sing. I used to dream about it where I would, you know, I'd wake up in the middle of the night and be like, oh, that was so cool. I got to act. Like I had a dream where I could actually sing and hit actual notes in front of human beings in a crowd. And I would have dreams like that. And I thought, well, one day it'd be really cool to be able to do that, but I can't sing. But I think the Jen episode really turned my attitude around on that, because even though you hear people who can sing go, oh no, it really is just practice. It really is just working at it. And you're like, But yeah, like what you said, go take the music lessons, go learn how. You can learn how. You can go and be part of it in those ways. And if I can sing on live podcast episode, you can too. I would say it that way, but yeah, I think there's probably another whole episode we could do on accessibility, and I wish we had the time to explore that here in a way that we could actually tackle that in a meaningful way. I struggle with that myself. But I do believe that if you put your mind to it and you practice, certainly if I can do it, you have some ability to do that too. And you should.
Absolutely. I've heard so many people, parents of students, you know, say, I don't know where my son gets this from. I don't have a musical bone in my body. Well, you just haven't exercised those musical bones in your body is all.
Right. Or your voice for that matter, you know, same thing.
Right.
You know, it's funny. I actually told Seth upstairs that he would be a really good singer, but he always does like bits and parody of things. And so, but every single time, like I was telling him yesterday, that he will parody sing a song, and he'll intentionally like sing it in a weird voice. But the strange thing is that he's always on pitch. He has good rhythm. He can match pitch when I sing with him. So, hi, Seth. I see you. Uh-huh. It's time to do karaoke.
You know, that's how Gonzo started. It was
really?
The same thing. It was, yeah, I can't sing, but I can sing in Gonzo voice because if I screw it up, it's just Gonzo. It's not. Now I have a multiple personality. No, like... No, I could just do Gonzo voice, and then it was funny. If he messed up, it was no big deal because it was like the silly voice. It wasn't my voice.
Right.
So Gonzo... And that... Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that makes total sense because students usually can hide behind their instrument in a way that makes them comfortable to play. Mm-hmm. But if you ask them to sing something, even if it's not pitch dependent, they won't do it because you're not hiding behind anything with your voice. But if you do the Gonzo voice, now you've got something to hide behind. So it makes it easier.
Right.
Kaz in our chat said, shh, don't out us like that. I think, if I had more music educators like you, thinking outside the box, encouraging to think beyond the classical rules of what is out there, that there would be a lot more people having this conversation of connection between people, having a connection to music when they're performing it. And yes, let's not discount that there is a little bit of technique that's necessary, but the broader approach of that is that there is so much emotion that can be in music. And if you disconnect from it, then you're just performing notes on a page. You're not performing music.
Absolutely.
And so I really wish that there are more music educators like you in the world. And I wish that anyone who gets to hear you speak and gets to hear your presentation on empathy really gives it a good listen.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Kaz said, excuse me while I hide behind my harp. I cannot.
And now a rousing rendition of Oh Danny Boy by Gonzo. I'm just kidding. we're not doing that.
I was really half expecting you to, and I was honestly kind of hoping you were.
This has been such a solid episode and such a touching episode. I'm not going to ruin it with that. So.
Duly noted. David, two last questions here for you. So say someone is kind of feeling down and out about the way that they are performing their music. They feel like they're connecting to it, but it's not eliciting the responses that they're wanting from it. And they come to you asking for advice. What do you tell them?
I would ask them first if they are clear with the goal of their performance. So what are they trying to achieve with that performance? Because I think it's a sort of backwards by design situation. You need to understand the goal in order to prepare for it properly. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing if they're feeling a disconnect, then they haven't yet truly embraced what they're trying to accomplish with that performance. So again, like the Veterans Day performance example we were giving before, you are giving those veterans an emotional memory, or you're supporting an emotional memory for them and bringing them back to a place. And in order to do that, you need to prepare in a certain way. Otherwise, you're not going to connect with that music. So that's probably where the disconnect is for that performer. And we'd want to start there.
That's a really great answer. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Kaz has a question. How does one get out of music burnout? Sorry, let me read that again. How does one get out of music burnout? As one who had a terrible, horrible, horrible music teacher that almost made me completely quit music permanently, how can you get that connection back and feel passion in the pieces again.
So there's two things at play here. It's very easy, and I've had this experience myself with some of the influencers on my musical journey along the way, where they impose restrictions on what is acceptable and what's not acceptable. Could be the music you're listening to, could be the music you're writing or performing, and you start to close yourself off to other musics, other experiences, other contexts, and that only does you an injustice. So making sure that you kind of back out of that situation a little bit and realize that there are probably some barriers that have been put in your way, emotional barriers, whatever they are, and addressing those and seeing if you can get beyond them. And once you do, that sort of innate joy of playing or listening or participating in music in some way will be there again. It's not that it's disappeared, it's just covered up in some way. So for that person, you know, finding the connection that initially got you into music in the first place. Was it listening to Foo Fighters and jamming along on your guitar? Then go get that Foo Fighters album, grab that guitar, and start playing your favorite tunes, because that's why we play music in the first place. And it's not about what the music is. It's, again, about how you connect to it. So, you know, if we want to say get back to your roots in some way, and just start fresh without those barriers, that's the way to get that done. And I've had to do that myself over the years, where I was, you know, feeling pressure from a little voice on my shoulder that said, you need to be listening to this or going this direction, when really my heart was telling me, yeah, but I'm connecting to this over here. And that's a difficult battle.
She said, because I'm sending this to my old harp group that was ruined by that teacher, we all have burnout and they need to hear this.
Mm.
We need more harp. So cause we'll schedule a concert at some point with harp. And we need to hear this. No, Archer, not more cowbell, please.
I'm just amazed that there was a group of harpists.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Phenomenal.
Yeah, let's get this group back together. What in the world? Tell them we said so.
Mm-hmm. Just need a really big truck to take that show on the road.
Yeah.
Yes.
We'll make that happen. Who do we know with a really big truck?
Oh.
I'll ask Jasmine. I feel like every time we've been like, I wonder if we could find a... Oh, yeah, Jasmine. She can get a castle. She can get a really big truck. A horse trailer. Oh.
You know what? That might work. Depending on the size of the harps, that might actually work. Well, David, this has done wonders. I'll echo a comment that I saw earlier to say that I, as a music person who have been studying for a while and taken a slight hiatus, I have feel more seen tonight in a while than I really have in a while. And that's not a common experience. So when I say it's truly been a joy to have you on this podcast, I really do mean that.
Thank you, Trey. I appreciate that. It's been a pleasure for me as well.
I'm glad. Before we go and before we wrap up tonight, I want to make sure that our listening audience and this incredible group of harpists that is going to have a fabulous reunion tour can connect with you. Where can some of our listening audience connect with you?
The easiest place is to go to my website. So that's davidschumacher.com. And there you can listen to my music and you can keep up to date on projects that are coming up in the future.
Awesome.
We'll watch for that. Yeah. And to any music educators looking for pieces, David Schumacher has some on his website as well. Just going to put that slight plug in there.
Thank you.
they are available for purchase on the website as well. But with that being said, as we transition our episode tonight to the close, we do want to thank our listening audience for tuning in as always and the incredible conversations that we get. This episode, along with probably every other episode, always and forever, will be in dedication to Joe Capone, our moderator, fellow comedian, passionate encourager, and greatly missed friend. You can find us pretty much wherever you tune into podcasts. For updates, announcements, and more, please follow us on social media under Modern Romantic. Thank you, everybody. Go bake cookies and listen to Santana.
Thank you, Emily. Thank you, Trey.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful day.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Hi, it's Emily, the host and creator of The Modern Romantic. And I wanted to let you know about something you may not be aware of. And that is, sometimes during the episode, you hear us referring to someone in the chat or someone in the audience. And that is because we record via live stream. What that means is we have a live show. It streams on our social media platforms, which would be Facebook, Twitter, Twitch, and YouTube right now. And we have a chat, and you can come and interact with us. And we ask the questions. You can interact with our guest. We comment and respond to comments, and it's a lot of fun, and it's a community, and we'd love for you to be a part of it. So come join us. We stream on Monday evenings with the occasional Sunday thrown in. Monday would be 5 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Mountain, 7 Central, and 8 Eastern. And Sunday is kind of it varies. You'll have to watch our social media. So come and join us. We'd love to see you there and have you be part of the show.